This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Fred Upton was first elected to Congress in 1986, although the district lines have changed a couple of times since then. The Republican has been representing some part of Southwest Michigan in the U.S. House. In November, voters will decide if Upton will serve another 2 years in Congress. Fred Upton, thank you for being here.
Always a pleasure.
What would you like to do if you have another term, two more years in the House?
Well, there's a whole laundry list of things, but first of all, I would note that last year I joined a group, a newly formed caucus called Problem Solvers, and it's a bipartisan. We have an equal number of Republicans and Democrats, four from Michigan, in fact. And I'd say that most of America has been upset, not happy with dysfunction in Washington on a host of fronts. And so we've sat down over the last number of months, and we know that we're going to have a new speaker. Paul Ryan is not running for re-election again. Most pundits out there suggest that we're going to have a close margin of control, either the Democrats by a handful or Republicans by a handful. So we're going to have a new speaker. We don't know who he or she will be, but our group has begun to sit down now with the prospects for the new speaker on both sides of the aisle, and we've let it be known that the rules have to change. We want to govern the way that, frankly, I learned back in ninth grade civics. And that is, we're going to take the best ideas on both sides of the aisle, Republican and Democrat. We're going to insist that they be considered and debated and voted on, and we'll let the chips fall where they may versus being denied the opportunity to offer a bipartisan solution that, in fact, may end up being in law. And this would apply to tax bills, would apply to spending bills. An issue that we really got involved in was immigration reform. I know that there's a bipartisan solution to a problem that needs to be fixed. And our bipartisan plan that I frankly, again, think the president could have signed was denied from being offered on the House floor. That's got to change. And so our insistence of these new changes for the next speaker are going to be pretty bold, and we're planning to introduce that in terms of a resolution, a formal bill, in essence, next week.
Well, let's start there with immigration, since that's the issue that you specifically brought up there. If we're just talking about Fred Upton's vote, how much is enforcement important? How much is security of borders a part
that has to be
an
element? So security of our borders needs to be part of the equation.
Does it have to be a wall?
Maybe for parts of the border, a wall might work. But there are other techniques, other things that you can use. I don't think a multi-thousand mile wall is the right approach to take, pretty expensive as well. But border security needs to be part of the equation. But we also know, let's face it, our immigration system today is broken. It's broken for the folks that are here. It's broken for the employers that try to hire these folks as well. This season, again, we're in Southwest Michigan, we're leaving millions of dollars of unpicked fruit and vegetables because they didn't have the workforce that's there. You read about stories about folks who come here to get educated. They come with a student visa, and all of a sudden they have employment opportunities that are pretty good. And guess what? Legally, they may not be able to stay. We want those jobs here. You know, we're going to be seeing great things happen in the next number of months and years here in Kalamazoo. Pfizer, an international company, Stryker, an international company, Whirlpool, an international company, Thermo Fisher, an international company. They want to be here. They want to expand here. And because of, you know, the laws of the way that they are, they've actually had to see some of these folks be sent overseas and expand over there. Let's figure out a system that works. Border security needs to be a piece of it. And those folks that are here that today are undocumented, we need to figure this out. If they want to become a citizen, there's a process for them to go through. But let's also fix the situation for the Dreamers here on campus. I've met with a good number of them over the last couple of years, actually. Many of them now are married. They've got families. They've got jobs. Maybe they came at age 4 or 5 here. They've been here for maybe as long as 15 or 20 years. This is their country. This is we want to make sure that they can stay.
Do you think that someone who came here illegally, even if maybe they did so intentionally at the outset, should still have an opportunity somewhere down the road to earn citizenship in the United States.
I do. There ought to be a process for that. I mean, obviously a background check to make sure they're not a member of like MS-13 or a criminal felony record. But we know that there are probably as many as 11 or 12 million folks like that. We're not going to send people home to, you know, wherever, whether it be Central America or Poland, as we saw with the case that was well documented here in Kalamazoo earlier this year. That's not going to happen. So let's figure this out. Let's figure out a way for them to be here with legal status. And again, if they want to become a citizen, there's a process for them to go through, and we ought to be doing that.
The tax cut bill, which was signed into law, you penned with some other representatives from Michigan an op-ed for the Detroit News, and you said the tax reform is working. Who is it working for? Because there are some reports of wages going up, but there's also some reports that inflation's starting to creep up, and that's eating into that gain that people should be getting in their wages.
Well, actually, I saw a report just this last week. Inflation went down last month, but you know, yesterday I spoke to the Portage Rotary, and the point was made that Pfizer, our largest employer in Southwest Michigan, is expanding to the tune of about $600 million, half a billion dollars, a new expansion. They're adding 400-some jobs. The average wage with benefits is over $90,000. That's coming because of the tax cut bill, the middle-class tax bill that the president signed a year ago. I can remember well that we used to have growth rates in the under 1% GDP. For the last two quarters, it's been over 4%, and the prediction is, again, for this next quarter, it's going to be over 4%. We saw a lot of businesses in our district and, frankly, around the country that gave bonuses, increased wages, and there was a report last week that I believe that the average middle-class income raise because of the middle-class tax cut was about $3,200 for a family of four earning $50,000, $60,000 because of the tax cut as it impacted them. So in large part, our growth in the economy is because of that tax bill that passed, and inflation is at least, you know, been held back a little bit. Gas prices are down. I mean, I can remember 9 years ago, gas price was $3.84 a gallon. I filled up this last week for $2.72. That's not bad.
There are projections of a $1 trillion deficit for next year, and the Congressional Budget Office says that there is some revenue which is not coming in because of the tax cut. Is the tax cut worth what we may experience in terms of a growing deficit?
Well, a couple things. We knew that the deficit would go up because of the tax bill. I said at the time, almost 2 years ago now, that I thought that the a growth rate that could be over the 2% projected, in essence it's 4% or better, is a very positive step in the right direction. As you look at the spending and revenues actually collected are at a record high, even though the tax cut came into play, spending is up. And frankly, there are some things that no one really accounted for. The hurricanes of last year were more than cost the taxpayers more than $100 billion that was unexpected. I don't know what the bill is going to be for Hurricane Florence. As we talk today, the flood waters are still rising. It has a terrible impact on the state of North Carolina. I've talked to a number of my colleagues from there, and the damage is just terrible. And we know some of the ramifications. You know, North Carolina is known for a lot of things, including agriculture. And so chickens and pork, those operations are shut down. Millions of chickens were killed, so we can expect prices to go up. Eggs, I mean, all of that different things as you think about the future. And we're going to have to help those citizens out. I don't know what the bill is going to be, but that's an unexpected cost. But at the same time, I would note, earlier this year, I supported a bipartisan package that the president signed on spending for both fiscal year 18 and 19. For the first time, in essence, we passed a two-year budget. It passed, I want to say it was 3-1. Both of our senators voted for it as well. Most of the Michigan congressional delegation on both sides voted for it. And as a consequence, we're not expected to have a shutdown. We can remember those in the past because there was an agreement on what's called discretionary spending. So the money for defense and education and agriculture, I mean, in essence, it was pre-agreed to last February, and the appropriators, as they send these bills to the House and Senate floor in the next couple of weeks as we get to the close of the fiscal year, September 30th, they're within those caps. So that was a good thing, and looking back, that we were able to get that thing done. So the spending side, in essence, was set. Some would suggest that the largest increase in spending is actually entitlements, Social Security, Medicare. But I've always been one to say, you know, if you deal with those, you've got to protect those folks that are currently drawing those benefits. That's a line in the sand for me. But whatever changes happen really have to be bipartisan. And the current climate doesn't promote that. You know, you'll remember well, the president in his campaign said, I'm not touching Medicare or Social Security. And certainly the Democrats, as we come close to this election now coming up in the next couple of weeks, they're not on that page either. So there's going to be no activity on the entitlement side, which, as we know, really is the most rapidly increasing part of the budget. So that's going to have to hold off for another day.
But you mentioned spending caps. But you also said that spending went up because of the hurricanes.
Well, that's...
It's hard to project into the future, but if you have more doesn't that mean that you got to spend more?
Thank you for raising that. So when you have emergency spending, that is outside of the spending cap. So that's a supplemental appropriation bill, and we'll have to deal with that separately. And that, because it's viewed as a, quote, emergency, it is not within the budget caps that we agreed to.
Okay.
I mean, you in essence, and you know, I don't know what the damages are going to be. I know that when we saw Houston, Puerto Rico, the American Virgin Islands, and Florida, that was pretty close to $100 billion. And that was, you know, no one knew that was going to happen in this current fiscal year.
There is some evidence from scientists saying that some of these hurricanes are getting stronger because of climate change. If, you know, this is impacting not just the budget, but also, of course, human life, does this mean that there is more urgency to doing something about climate change?
Yeah. So for me, I've never been a denier on climate change. It's been happening for some time. As the chairman of the Energy Subcommittee, I've always been a supporter of. Now, I thought pulling out of the Paris Agreement was a mistake.
At the time, though, we entered did you support going in, or did you oppose
it? Well, it wasn't a vote in the House, but at the time that the president pulled out, I was very vocal that we shouldn't pull out.
But when President Obama entered into it?
The House didn't have a role. Remember, it was never submitted to the Senate for a treaty. There was no implementing legislation as part of the Paris talks.
Did you say anything in support or in opposition?
It was years ago.
I'll find it later. Yeah, so go ahead.
But when this president pulled out, I said that it was a mistake. I've always supported greater energy efficiencies. I've been a big supporter of. You know, I've been a longtime supporter of an all-of-the-above energy policy, which includes renewables. And earlier this week, complimented Consumers Energy and other Michigan utilities for the goal that they have that I think they're going to be able to achieve, and that is by 2040, we're going to have 40% of our electricity that's generated coming from renewable sources. That includes wind and solar. In fact, we just cut the ribbon with Dr. Montgomery, president of Western, earlier this week on a new battery that will be able to take some of that energy from the solar park that will actually be able to fuel or to provide electricity for up to 1,000 homes. That's a great thing. And by seeing that happen, you know that we're going to be able to hit this 40% renewable target by 2040.
So you say you have not been a denier, but... The last time I asked you about this, you did say that it was above your pay grade to say whether or not it's caused by humans.
I didn't.
Where do you stand on that?
Yeah, well, humans, I do believe, have a role here, and certainly we ought to be taking steps to reduce carbon emissions. Here in this country, we actually have. We've actually reduced carbon emissions from where we were 10, 15 years ago. That's a good thing. I support that.
Can we do more?
I think that we can. And we here in Michigan, we're going to be able to see that, particularly when we go to renewables. And we have, of course, we have better fuel efficient cars. We have more fuel efficient appliances, a whole host of things that have led us to have fewer emissions than we've had before. And that's a good thing.
One of the issues that the Democrats are hitting you hard on is the health care bill. If that health care bill that you had voted for and passed the House had become law, what would that have meant for people with, say, pre-existing conditions? There was an opt-out for states under that bill that would have allowed them to not have that requirement, correct?
Yeah, a couple things. So let's, as we reflect back on Obamacare, the way that it came about, there were a lot of promises of what was going to happen, that you could keep your health care plan if you liked it, that premiums were going to come down, everyone was going to be covered. And it's now been a good number of years. Not every, you know, we still have millions of folks that are not covered. In Michigan, more than 100,000 folks, in fact, lost their health care plan. Premiums have gone up double digits some years. They didn't go down at all. I had a couple lines in the sand as we debated this. And of course, as we know, the Senate didn't pass it, so it didn't happen. But a couple lines in the sand that I had were, one, for states like Michigan, 26 at the time, there's I think another one or two since then, we expanded Medicaid coverage. And I wanted to protect those people. And we worked that into the bill that passed the House. I think that if we had ended up getting a bill through the Senate, that those protections would have been made whole again. I wasn't worried about that. But also in the bill, we made it very clear that those with pre-existing illnesses, in fact, would be covered. Now, there was a provision that was added later that allowed a state, if they chose to drop pre-existing illnesses as part of their basic package, Michigan was not going to be one of those, but if another state did, that would be a real problem, particularly for someone like me who supports those with pre-existing illnesses not to be charged more, not to be excluded from coverage. So I was successful in getting a number of colleagues to support with me an amendment that would have provided billions of dollars for high-risk pools for those states that might have dropped that coverage. That amendment was added to the bill. Again, I think that had the Senate passed a bill, that we could have made it even stronger. But I felt that it would have adequately protected those with pre-existing illnesses. And of course, you know, as it turned out, no legislation moved forward because it didn't pass in the Senate.
As I recall, when you were here after the vote in the House, and we didn't know what would happen in the Senate, you were very insistent that you were expecting some changes in the Senate.
Yeah, that would have been even more positive.
Right.
That it would have even been more. And I would have been a member of the conference committee, and I would have insisted on that if any legislation moved forward.
So as we sit here and talk right now, would it have been better to have passed the House bill as it was and send it to President Trump to sign into law, or are we better off that there was no bill ultimately passed?
You know, I'm convinced that, you know, the bodies should work together. There were some things that I would have liked. You know, it goes back to what we talked a little bit of earlier with the problem solvers. I'm one that wants to take the best ideas and move them forward. And there were some good ideas, I think, that were in the Senate, that would have been in the Senate proposal that we would have accepted, or I would have worked to see if we could have done that to make it a better bill. So I would have preferred to actually see the Senate pass something, go to conference, and see what we come up with, versus having them just, quote, accept the House version.
But you wanted an improvement on the House bill, even though you voted for it, and even though it was probably your amendment that got it through.
Well,
I mean, at least it got your vote, and your vote was pretty important.
Yeah, well, we would not have been able to slip back. That's for sure. And I think we could have made it better. I would have worked to try and do that.
Speaking of health, what's the federal government's role or responsibility when it comes to safe drinking water for places like Parchment, where PFASs have been found?
We have a lot of work to do on this, and I'll just go back in the history on this. I worked very closely with Congressman Dan Kildee a couple years ago on Flint. I'll confess I had never been to Flint, before. You know, I grew up in Southwest Michigan. I went to Chicago. I went to Detroit. I went along the lakeshore. I never went to Flint until I joined Dan to firsthand look at the situation. And we learned that the EPA had been aware of the lead issue in Flint for nearly a year before they fessed up. President Obama, to his credit, fired the EPA administrator the next day when he learned what she had done. Dan Kildee and I then worked on legislation that we moved through the House lickety-split that requires that whenever the EPA learns about something like this in the future, that literally within 24 hours they have to work with the state, they have to tell them what's going on, and to work on a plan to remedy the situation. That's now what's happened in Parchment. Governor Snyder put out an order that all communities, not just those over 10,000, all communities have to be tested for PFAS. And with Parchment, they tested literally on a Monday, and by Thursday they knew the result, that it was way 20 times in excess of the maximum exposure standard. And we let the citizens of Parchment and Cooper Township know right away, literally within an hour. Now, where do we go from here? We held a hearing in the Energy and Commerce Committee, a committee that I serve on, a couple weeks ago now. I'm very concerned about Fort Custer. You know, PFAS is in a lot of things. It's in Gore-Tex, it's in hats, it's in shoes, it's in paper, it's in foam, firefighting foam. And of course, as we know, many of our military bases, particularly if they have an airfield, they're training all the time. And guess what? They've used this foam and it gets into the groundwater. And they tested a number of sites within Fort Custer earlier this year, and they found, at least preliminarily, that PFAS is in excess of in the tens of thousands parts per trillion. Remember, the standard is 70. So I introduced legislation earlier this week with Dan Kildee, my colleague from Flint, and Debbie Dingell and Tim Walberg, two Republicans, two Democrats, to insist that on federal facilities, Fort Custer and others, that we really come up with a game plan of enforcement to work with the states, to work with the EPA, to identify these bad sites, and to come up with a plan to remedy the situation. Now, as it relates to Parchment, thank goodness, and I credit Sheriff Fuller and the team that was assembled at the Emergency Operating Center, you know, this last 6-8 weeks, they're lucky. They could tie into the Kalamazoo water system almost overnight. I mean, it took a little while, but I mean, you know, that's pretty unique to have that happen. There are still real situations, real problems with some of the private wells that were never attached to the city water. We have some funds to help, Clean Water Drinking Fund. But the problem for Michigan is those decisions on those dollars were made last spring, prior to what we knew about Parchment and Cooper Township. All of the money was reserved, and unlike some states that actually have a reserve balance, because of Flint, there is none. So we can't look at that until next spring, and it's the next fiscal year. So I'm working on a number of different options to try and help speed up that process that would allow folks with private wells to hook into municipal system. But, you know, what we saw in Parchment, there's probably other situations, not only in Michigan, but elsewhere around the country, and we've got to work on this.
Well, in the broader view here of other chemicals, the things we may learn about, you know, should we be concerned about an administration which has said that it wants to loosen regulations, which has had, appointed people to the EPA who are talking about, kind of getting out of the way? Is that a concern? Should we be a little more cautious about what we're allowing in the water?
Yeah, well, a couple things. So how did we learn about PFAS? I mean, I would say that most people, still probably plenty today, have never heard of it. We passed, when I was chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee, we passed for the first time in 40 years a requirement. It's called, everything's got an acronym in Washington, but a toxic chemical bill, TOSCA is what it was called. We passed it, I think, with just one member of Congress voting no. And the Senate did the same thing. And that went, President Obama signed it into law, and it requires EPA to look at all of these chemicals and do an assessment and figure out where we were. So that was, again, under President Obama. And that has helped us now set the standard for PFAS, again, 70 parts per trillion. And before we knew about parchment, I joined with a number of my colleagues, both sides of the aisle, to send a letter, and this is in mid-July, to EPA asking if that standard ought to be a lower number than 70. And if it needs to be, how do we expedite that process so that we know that it's safe for all the folks that may be exposed to this? EPA has an important role. I have opposed efforts to cut back on EPA funding, and they need to be part of this process, which is why I work not only on the Flint situation, but obviously now with PFAS as well.
Have you gotten an answer from the EPA yet?
No, we haven't. We did a letter. I want to say there were about 9 or 12 of us that signed a letter. It included Jack Bergman from the Upper Peninsula, Debbie Dingell, Dan Kildee, myself, other members, other states. We've not gotten an answer yet from EPA.
After he lost the Republican primary for governor this year, Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly said the reality is that this is President Trump's Republican Party now. Do you agree with that, and are you comfortable with that as you run for reelection?
Well, you will remember, I'm sure it's in your notes, in 2016, we chose, as we said, to stay in our lane. I did not make an endorsement even after the convention for president. I just said, we're going to stay in our own lane. We're going to work on our own race. And I have not been, in my almost 2 years now since the president has taken office, I've not been afraid to oppose him on whatever issue I thought was important. And I've got, whether it be Charlottesville, whether it be Great Lakes funding, you'll remember his budget zeroed that out. We restored it 100%. Whether it be the Paris, getting out of the Paris Treaty, cutting children's health, cutting food stamps, I've not been afraid to speak out and vote against when I thought he was wrong, as I've done other Republican presidents as well. So Brian Kelly had a tough race. We know that in primaries, yeah, the president's got a pretty big stick. He endorsed pretty heartily Bill Schuette, which was not unexpected, I gotta say. He endorsed John James in the Senate race. John James won his primary as well against Sandy Pensler. And I'd say among the base, and the polls show this too, yeah, the president's pretty popular. Does it work so well in November? We'll see.
There may be voters, though, who say that they want more of a check on President Trump. And you may cite the votes, but they may say, yeah, but as long as the Republicans have control of the House, that is not as much of a check as some people may want, especially in a district like this one, which, has gone back and forth in terms of who has been supported for president in the past.
Yeah, I mean, our district's a swing district. It went for Bill Clinton. It went for Barack Obama. It went for this president, too, narrowly, but it went for him, went for George Bush, Bush 43. So, again, for me, I mean, people know that I'm a moderate. I'm, co-chair of the Tuesday Group, a group that I helped found. We have about 40 or 50 Republicans, a member of the Problem Solvers, which, again, is bipartisan, member of Main Street Partnership, which has a founding member of that as well. And, I got to say, as I look at my colleagues, I've got great friends on both sides of the aisle, and I work together on a good number of issues. And, as I go door to door, as I speak to service clubs, as I did yesterday at Portage Rotary, people, they don't really care if you have an R or a D next to your name, at least in our district. Yeah, you've got the bases for sure. But they want the job done, and that's what I've tried to do. And my record reflects that. And as a consequence, that's how I've won in Democratic years and how I've won in Republican years. And, I've got scars to prove it.
I was going to wrap up there, but you used a word that stood out to me, moderate, because there are plenty of people who've run against you have said at one time they thought Fred Upton was moderate. They think he's become more conservative. And over time, I really haven't heard you use the term moderate very often. Is it something you're reclaiming here?
No, it's, I mean, people, you know, I started the, helped start the Tuesday group back in the early 90s. And, you know, it's not a doctrinaire group. We've got people on all sides of, you know, you name the issue. And, but it's, I'd like to think that we're a thoughtful group. We're going to ask questions, and we're going to decide what's best for the country in terms of where our votes are. It was not difficult for me to say, you know, I got a line in the sand on Great Lakes funding. I know that the president zeroed that out, but as we take on Asian carp, as we take on water quality, our delegation, Republican and Democrat, stood together. As we look at, you know, projects, whether it was expanding I-94 here in Kalamazoo or working to get a new lock, the POLOC, up in the Upper Peninsula, our delegation, Republicans and Democrats, pretty much stand together in terms of what we're doing. As we look at the auto industry, and, you know, I talked to John Dingell, who's recovering from a heart attack earlier this week. He and I are great friends. He was the dean of the House, my predecessor to some degree, and he chaired the Energy and Commerce Committee back in the 90s and early 2000s. He and I worked together to save the auto industry. We were the two people who wrote the House bill on the auto rescue plan, which without it, Michigan never would have recovered from the recession. And we've seen auto sales, you know, practically double from where we were before. Again, it was bipartisan. It was at the end of President Bush's term and the beginning of President Obama. And frankly, Ed Montgomery and I met during those discussions way back when. So I've got a record of working together, and I think that's what most of my constituents want us to see.
Republican Congressman Fred Upton is running for re-election in Michigan's 6th Congressional District. As always, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Gordon.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.